Let me say to each and every one of you that are joining us this evening, tonight is October the 4th of November the 4th of the year 2015, and those of you that are joining us tonight by way of the podcast, we want you to know that we are absolutely thrilled that you are listening in. You are at Tabernacle Baptist Church this evening, a church that's located in downtown Richmond, Virginia, in the heart of an area known as the Fan District. And we are now deep into a series on sexuality and faith. And we want you to know that your presence with us this evening, be it in the year 2015 or even 10 years from now, is something that we cherish. We welcome each and every one of you. We have created this series as an opportunity for the church to come together and talk about something that matters, but also help put it in its place. We live in a culture where everywhere we look, there is sex. And with one exception, at church. And so we have come together here in the belly of Tabernacle Baptist Church in the basement in the fellowship hall to talk about something that really matters, but also to help put it in perspective. The hope is that on the other side of the series, that not only Tabernacle is a local church, but also any church that participates in this dialogue will have a better way to talk about it whenever it's time to talk about it and to do so freely. This evening, Dr. Wright and Dr. Hartman are going to get a break. They're going to get to sit down and participate with the rest of us. And Reverend Kristen Koger, the pastoral resident at Tabernacle Baptist Church, is going to lead us. The specific theme is young children and sexuality tonight. And we welcome, it sounds weird to say we welcome Kristen, but we do. We welcome her to this side of the microphone for the series. So Kristen, thanks for your good leadership tonight. Lead us well, friend.
Thank you all for the opportunity to be here tonight. When we first talked about this series, Art mentioned that there was going to be a week devoted to children and a week devoted to youth and asked if I would be interested, and I jumped at the chance as I love working with children and hope to be an associate pastor to children and families in the future. And I'm already working with many of you with your families. So thank you for the opportunity to come and learn and lead this evening. Yes, we are talking about how to talk with young children about sex and sexuality tonight. It's not as scary as it sounds, I promise, even so much that I put it on the screen. And I'm going to adjust my view so I can see what is coming. There we go. All right. So a little bit about me and my experience and where I'm coming from. You all have heard some of this from Tracy and Art as they have shared during the week. I come to the table a person who is becoming more and more open and comfortable with this topic as each week passes. Our household was not necessarily a closed household, which we'll talk about this evening, in that sex wasn't ever talked about, but it also wasn't something that was talked about frequently. We didn't always use anatomically correct language when talking about genitalia. I remember when I got the talk, quote unquote, from my mom. I actually don't remember when I got the talk from my mom. I've completely blocked that out of my memory. I promise I have no recollection of her telling me anything about this, but she swears that I was on the ground screaming with my hands over my ears, like, that's gross, stop talking to me, just cut it out. My brother did not get the talk. That was my dad's responsibility, and my dad said, yeah, that's okay. He's the last born, like, he'll just get it at school. So that's a little bit about where I'm coming from and how I have interacted with my family about talking about sex and sexuality. It's still not something that's talked about openly in our house, just because I think my parents were not all that comfortable with it. So I hope that things tonight encourage you all as you continue to raise your children or interact with children. All of us are going to interact with children at some point, especially in this building, and so I hope that tonight is helpful for that. Most of the facts and things that you will hear tonight comes from a book by Kate Ott called Sex and Faith, which Art discovered last year at a conference, and it is a phenomenal book. Regardless of where you are on the spectrum, this book is very helpful, so I definitely recommend, if you want more detailed information than what we'll hear tonight and next week, to go ahead and check out this book. Mine has notes in it, and I would like it back, but if you want to peruse it, this evening, you are more than invited to do so. This book has a very balanced approach of physical, spiritual, and developmental aspects of children. So it doesn't just focus on sex or just focus on religion. It kind of covers the spectrum, which is not always seen in books. But to start out with, we are going to show a clip from the TV show host John Oliver. We are not showing the entire clip. I will just give you the disclaimer that if you decide to go home and look this up on YouTube, the longer it goes, the racier it gets. It is very funny. But the things said in this video and language that may be used does not reflect upon Tabernacle Baptist Church. but we're going to watch the first 5 minutes, which is, I think, is funny. If you can see through the humor and see some of the facts, it's about sex education. So we're going to take a few minutes to watch this, and then we'll have some discussion moving forward.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Art. If you want to view the video that Kristen is showing, you can Google John Oliver Sex Education, and a link should pop up to YouTube. Kristen showed the first 5 minutes of the video, which I think are helpful for sort of establishing the context of sex education in the United States and in schools in general these days. So hope you enjoy.
All right. So this goes on and talks about all these things. And so a couple of things that I looked up after this it's like a dance party. Looked up after this just because Oliver mentions the different regulations that states have. And some of you teachers in the room might be able to correct me if I'm wrong. But what I read on the National Conference of State Legislatures website was that Virginia does not have state mandated sex education. Like, there's not one curriculum that all children receive. They leave that up to the school boards. They do provide guidelines if you are choosing to teach sex education in your school, but the guidelines that I read were more of abstinence education than they were about sex. It was about not having sex, the options of adoption if an unwanted pregnancy comes up, and those sorts of things. So that was something that I thought was relevant since we are in Virginia. I have more statistics from that website if anyone would like them. I'm happy to send them to you. It was quite interesting to see some of the things that states require and some of the statistics in various states. So we're going to jump into Ott's book. The way that the book is set up is that the first half of the book kind of sets up how you are going to talk to your children about sex and your youth, and then the second part divides out into the developmental stages. So a big chunk of what I'm going to talk tonight is the first part, but it's somewhat necessary in order to move into the second part, and then we'll jump into the earliest ages. So some myths that we see that Ott describes when you're talking to your children about sex and sexuality is that your child is too young to understand any of this. That is a myth because you are seeing things through adult eyes. So if your child walks in on you in the bathroom while you're showering or getting dressed, and they ask you, what is that? And they point to a part of your body. They might just want to know what it is. You do not need to freak out and say, get out of here, like, close your eyes, you shouldn't be in here. They're just curious and asking questions. And so children can understand this. We've talked about multiple times how it is important to use anatomically correct language. It's okay for a boy to know that he has a penis and a girl to know she has a vagina and that those are different. It's not something that you need to be embarrassed about. Parents often provide too little information too late. And when polled, students, particularly in middle and high school, said that they wish that their parents had talked more about sex and sexuality in their home because they had questions but didn't know if it was okay or safe to ask them. So knowledge is power. The second myth that we have is once you explain how babies are made, my job is done. I've already talked about my experience of the talk, and that is not necessarily the only time that you need to talk with your children about sex and sexuality. Sexuality is more than just one act, is more than just you do these things in order to get pregnant and have a child. It includes relationships and your bodies and gender roles and identity. You're probably already doing some of these things and not even knowing, or you're not calling it sexuality. So when you talk with your children about how to clean themselves or how to take care of their bodies, that is a part of sexuality. You're just not calling it that. So congratulations, if you're doing those things, you're doing just fine. The third myth is that talking about sex is going to lead your child or your youth to experimentation. Studies have shown that the exact opposite is true, that more information for children lets them make decisions and they know what the outcomes are, and therefore it empowers them to make those decisions and helps them to delay becoming sexually active. We need to talk about this. One statistic in the book said that half of teens who say they are having sex did not know about contraception before their first time having sex. And so giving them information, even if you hope that they choose not to engage in sexual activity, if you have at least given them the information about how to be safe, that is something that is important. And it may be that they decide, well, I might be able to get sick or get an infection from this, and therefore, because I have that information, I'm not going to experiment. The fourth myth is that you have to have all the answers. I don't think that I, nor Tracy, nor Art have all of the answers on this topic. It is okay. A lot of times parents get quote-unquote performance anxiety when your child comes to them with questions. Be honest if you don't know the answer. Just say, I have no idea. I'm going to look that up and I'll get back to you. That helps build trust with your children and lets them know that you do care about this topic and that it's something that's okay to keep asking. And then don't say, I'll look it up, and not look it up. You need to follow up with that. And the practice helps as you're answering questions. And then the last myth is that you only have to do this once. We've talked about this some already. This is a lifelong process. I hope that all of you have learned something about sexuality in this class, and we range in age from 2 years in the back of the room with Wit and 6 months with Emily, all the way up to 80-year-olds. This is an important part. Another thing to keep in mind when you talk with your children about sex and sexuality, there's some more of these. What we say is just as important as where we say it. So there is a story in the book about a girl who all she remembers is being in a dim room with the door closed. That gives the impression that sex is something that we don't talk about and we don't want other people to hear. So even if you're giving all the information, your environment and your location is just as important when you're talking with children. Facts disappear, so again, you need to talk about this more than once. I do not remember the talk. My mother should have followed up with me later in life, because the first time you talk to a child about it, they're probably like, what is happening? This is gross. Like, why would anyone ever do this? Or they're freaked out because they're finding out about periods and nocturnal emissions, and so you need to follow up with them, maybe not the same day, but in a couple days, continue to have conversation. Just because kids don't ask questions doesn't mean they have them. If you spend any time with a child of any age, they will have questions, but how you approach the situation is going to help them know if it is okay or not okay to ask questions. So being open and honest with your children and your youth is crucial for this, so that they feel comfortable asking questions to you. And finally, if you don't give them information, they're going to find it elsewhere. It might be incorrect, and you won't be able to have control over what they learn and how they learn it. I remember that one of the first times that I heard anything related to sex, I was probably in second grade, I think, and it was through the form of a very dirty and inappropriate joke from a little boy who lived down the street. And so for years, that's what I thought sex was using all of these euphemisms. I will not repeat the joke to you ever. And so my parents, you know, like, had they talked to me, then I would kind of know what these different things were, and know that it was more than just a joke to laugh off in the long run. So, how's everyone doing? Anyone have questions? Yeah? No, I'm going to refuse that, to share that one with you. Sorry, I'm still a little bit scarred from it. Yeah. Okay. So the comment was that in Hanover County, in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, you have to opt out of sex ed, and that the class that they do teach is pretty in-depth. So that's good to know, to follow up on the sex-mandated stuff that I was talking about earlier. Okay, good. And they leave that up to school boards, too. So it might be that, I mean, I'm glad that that's what Hanover does, giving parents the option of looking at it and participating. Okay, so... many of you all in the room are parents, and many of you listening are parents. Some of you want to be parents or have been and are now empty nesters, and some of you are not parents at all, but you interact with children or you're just curious about the topic. So we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the parents' role as they interact in this conversation. Parents raise children. They do not own children. So we are stewards of God's creation. We have been created in God's image, and all human beings, regardless of race or gender or orientation, you can fill in the blank, have God-given dignity and worth, and that deserves to be nurtured. And so as a parent, we are required to take care of our children so that they then realize how much they are worth, and that they have worth and have dignity. You all are the first educators and primary stewards, but you also share that responsibility. If you wander next door on any given Wednesday night, there are half a dozen parents in the room with children from all families, and they are interacting and sharing life together. Your children need more than one or two adults to contribute to their upbringing. They need to have adults that they can trust, and those adults might be people that they then go to if they're not comfortable talking with you about sex or sexuality or a career choice or, you know, something going on at school. And so while you are responsible for your children and their upbringing, there are other people that they are interacting with, teachers, mentors, friends, that are also responsible for that. And you in turn play that role for other children that cross at your path. And then the last thing to know about the parent's role is that you should model your values by your behavior, not just by saying. A lot of times we hear, do as I say, not as I do. That should be the exact opposite of what we do when it comes to raising children in faith and in sexuality, is that the practice what you preach. You need to be a mentor and a role model. This is a process. There is no end goal. It's a continual journey. And so modeling that for your children is absolutely crucial. So we are going to talk a little bit about how faith plays into this. I might skip through some of this, and I will happily email this out later just because of time, because I want us to make sure we have time for everything. So how faith plays into this are in some core Christian beliefs, those being that God is love, that Jesus was human, and that Scripture teaches us how to live. We read in the Bible that God said, "Let us make humankind in our image," and that God saw all that he had made and that it was good. In both of these scriptures from Genesis 1, we see that God is love. And that everything that God does is in love. And it teaches us two fundamental issues, that we have been created by God, and that includes our sexuality, and that the greatest commandment is to care for each other, and that means caring for others and their sexuality too. That doesn't mean having sex with others. It means caring for their sexuality. Remember, those are two very different things, which we have established throughout this series. So those are two things that we need to remember. And then the last one, it comes from Luke from the New Testament, that says, "Love God with all of your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself." So as a parent, it is crucial for us to instill respect into our children for other people. And then as children get older, they will realize that having respect for this person doesn't mean just treating them nice, but connections will be made in their sexual relationships as they develop, if that is the path that they choose. Hopefully these things will cross over and become integral to that. Couple more faith things. So our faith community, we've talked about how children need more adult than one or two adults that are responsible in helping raise them. Children need to see multiple examples of all ages that are modeling healthy and loving relationships. So that may start with high school students in the youth group that are treating them each other with respect and holding hands or just caring for one another, all the way up to, for example, Mr. and Mrs. Cochran, who have been married for 80 plus years. Everyone in the spectrum, regardless of, even if you're married or not married, just in relationship with other people, how we care and love for each other. Kids are less likely to engage in risk behavior or risk-taking behavior if they understand that they have a purpose in life. If there is a child who doesn't think that anyone loves them or cares for them, they are more likely to go out and do something dangerous, whether that be a physical danger, sexual danger, whatever, if they don't feel like anyone cares. So having a community, especially a faith community for that, is very helpful. Faith practices that we see, a couple that we're going to talk about are prayer and rites of passage. Prayer fosters communication and it allows reflection. And those things are both helpful as we build relationships with others. So when we're talking to God, we're talking or thinking about talking and we're reflecting on ourselves. That is something that in the long run will be helpful in healthy relationships. Rites of passage, what are some rites of passage that we do here at Tabernacle that involve our children? Anyone shout them out? Okay, Sunday school transitions, baptisms, baby dedications or toddler dedications, aging out of worship explorers, and we'll throw the nursery, aging into worship explorers. We give Bibles is a new tradition we started this year, or a rite of passage. I guess this year Bibles are books as you transition to those. Are there any others that you walk in, and maybe not even from this context, are there others in other churches you've experienced? Okay, honoring graduates from any age of school. Okay. So these rites of passage often happen around, it might not be intentional, but they're happening around key transitions in sexual and relational development. So even if we're not having the rite of passage because these teens have now entered into puberty, when they move from fifth grade to sixth grade, that is sort of the beginning of when that happens. And so we are honoring their sexuality and their development and their relationships by connecting those sorts of things to church. We're not coming out and saying it, but finding ways to affirm children as they are transitioning and getting older and going through these rites of passage definitely helps as we're interacting with kids. Any questions about faith connection things? Lovely. It's pretty front, like, what's the straightforward? I was going to say front forward. That's not the right word. but yeah. Okay. So what is sexuality education? Not what is sex education. Again, two different things. Remember that these messages will change with age, which we will see as we talk about developmental changes in children. And so something that you will tell your five-year-old may not be something that you won't say it the same way as you're telling your 15-year-old and vice versa. And it might be different based on your ethnicity or your location or where you're living or your religious belief. Important thing to remember is that our sexuality is silenced and we feel shame when a parent or adult dismisses our questions or we are not prepared for natural things and biological things that happen. So if a girl gets her first period and she has not been prepared for that, how terrifying would it be for you to all of a sudden be bleeding and not know what's going on? Or a boy wakes up and he has had a wet dream during the night and he has no idea what is going on. So we don't want to dismiss questions or not prepare our children because you are automatically sending the message that this is wrong, this is not something we talk about. And that can be more damaging than good. So when you are talking about sex and sexuality education, have self-confidence and instill in your children's self-confidence because it allows them to make decisions based on beliefs and values that they have formed themselves, and you can help guide some of that as they're younger. Work on your communication skills, so using correct language, being honest and open about questions, that gives everyone the ability to articulate feelings and decisions, and then helps with decision making. So you can start decision making at a younger age by giving limited options and allow children to explore the consequences and the possible outcomes, and in the long run, when they get older, they will be able to think through that a little more than if they weren't prepared for this. We've talked about how knowledge is power, whether that is giving children and youth information about sex or sexual acts, or it could be, if you don't feel comfortable talking with this about me, please, you know, you can call these people, or you can go to this teacher for help. So giving them the information to know how to care for themselves is something that is important. But most important of all is to have patience with your children. It is the most important of all. I don't know that it would be possible to be a parent or someone who works with children without patience. So just keep that in mind as you are talking and learning. Take time to teach, take time to listen, and to answer questions with your children. We are going to take a little quiz. There are some of these that you may hear next week when Art is back leading, so be prepared. These are true or false questions, so we'll take a quick poll around the room after we've read them just by raising your hand. I won't call you out. True or false, kids go through puberty sooner than their parents' generation. Today, children are going through puberty sooner than their parents' generation. Who thinks it is true? Okay, who thinks it is false? The trues won. The response is a trick question, both false and true. Sorry to mess that up for you. So the beginning of menstruation and the development of sperm and boys' first ejaculation hasn't changed much in the last 50 years, but what has changed in the last 50 years are secondary sex characteristics, which would be the development of breasts, the hair growth, and the lowering of the voice. In the United States, that is beginning much earlier than it has in the past. But sexual development has remained mostly the same since the 1900s, with the exception, like we said, of these secondary sex characteristics. Next question. True or false, sexualized music and media are corrupting children's innocence. Who thinks that is true? Oh, man. Who thinks it is false? Who has no idea? So, yes, it is. So the answer is false on this one, kind of. So, you know, back when my parents were children, rock and roll was corrupting the nation. And, you know, so there's always been things that parents think that media and music are corrupting the innocence. It's not the actual music and media. Technology itself isn't bad, but parent involvement is crucial in this too, so keep that in mind. Yeah. Yeah. So the question that was asked was, does violent games or violent music make people violent? And the response was, does patriotic people make people patriotic? Is how you could ask that question back at them. Yes. I would look through the notes and get back to you, because I don't have it memorized, but I promise to follow up. This is something you should say to your child if they were to ask you this question. Yeah. So one thing that has changed is that media and music are more sexualized now than they have in the past. About 3/4 of TV shows that youth are watching contain sexual content, but only about 1/3 of the time do they reference the risk and the responsibility that comes from being sexually active. So while the actual things, the music and the media, are more sexualized, that part is true, but is that directly corrupting children's innocence? You just kind of gotta figure that out. And again, that might be based on parent involvement or lack of involvement. That's a really good question, you person who asked it. So, all right, last one. True or false, kids get all of their sexuality information from the internet. I should have underlined all of their sexuality information from the internet. True, false. Well done. Everyone should have had their hand up on that one. False is the answer. They do not get all of their information from the internet. Most surveys report that most children and youth get their information from their mothers. Following in order that is doctors, and then teachers, and then friends are a close second. So fathers, you need to step it up. but that's just on this survey. I mean, if it was my dad that was asked, it would be different. So the internet can do you a lot of good. You will see on your table, and we'll talk about resources at the end, that there are some resources that are listed. So the internet can be very beneficial, especially if you yourself has questions. You might want to caution your children on if they are typing in things of a sexual nature online. So it can also do a lot of damage, both for children and for adults. And so just be careful if you're letting your child explore things and find answers for themselves. All right. We're getting there. So help, my child is asking me questions, and then we're going to do some developmental things on this. So some steps, there's 5 steps for you to take if your child comes up and asks you a question. First is just to breathe. Focus on the question. Try to control your facial expression. You want to set the tone for the conversation. So if you instantly freak out, your child is going to take that in and be like, okay, never going to him again for that or her. But if you are calm about it, then it will, you'll have a much better conversation. You want to clarify the question specific, or especially if it is a younger child or just in general, but specifically with younger children, you might hear a child come home and say, what does sex mean? And if you say, well, where did you hear that? The teacher said that boys and girls are a different sex. That's a different answer you're going to give than I heard my sister talking on the phone saying she was having sex with her boyfriend. So you just want to clarify the question, and you want to make sure that you are answering the question they're asking. Again, you're looking at things through adult eyes, not always children's eyes. You want to provide accurate and age-appropriate information. We'll get into this when we talk about different ages. And the important thing with this, the accurate part, is that if you make a mistake, admit that and correct it. Again, that is something that builds trust. When your child comes to you and asks a question, it gives you the opportunity to share your values on that topic. And those can be faith values or just general moral values that you have. But this also is a great opportunity to help children see that sex and sexuality and faith go together. And then finally, you need to follow up with them. So ask if there are other questions and if they understood everything that you said. And then find a teachable moment in the future, whether it's a few days or weeks or months, where you can refer back to the conversation so you can make sure that they still are understanding and are still comfortable talking about this. All right, so now you're ready to go talk. Yes. Right. yes, that is not on the list to go ask someone else. But that could be to share your values. I don't know, follow up by asking someone else. Yes, so by any means, if you are not comfortable talking with your child about this, I hope all of you will at some point. But finding those adults that are in your child's life that they can talk to is something that's definitely important. That's a good point. Yeah, that media and music can force our hand maybe sooner than we would like for it to have that conversation. So that's a good point. Right. Sure. How do you balance that? Yes, so the question was, how do you balance teaching your child about sex and sexuality if they are completely adamant and don't want to hear about it and kicking and screaming the whole way? Do any of you parents have advice on that? Have you had this experience? I'll gladly put you in touch with my mom to see what she did. But any of you in the room, how do you approach that? Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, for one sitting. So doing it in stages is good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. You had established trust in the space for that to happen. Yeah, good. Well, and so I think something for me that might have been helpful was if my mom had, maybe she did, again, I don't remember, but I don't feel like she gave me any sort of heads up. Like, I think it was just one night, like, she came in my room and this conversation started. Like, had I been prepared somehow, like, we're going to talk about some things tonight about puberty and your body changing. Like, for me, I mean, that's the type of person I am. If you just give me even 12 hours warning, I'm a lot more receptive to things than if it's completely spontaneous out of the blue. But all good things about following up and finding ways to connect. Those are all, does that help somewhat? Okay, good. Well done. All right. We're going to keep going just because I want to be sensitive to time and give you all time for questions and answers. I'm just going to say we're probably not going to go through all of these different things. The way that Ott sets up her book in each chapter or each developmental age is that she gives descriptions of how children, like in this first section from birth to kindergarten, are growing and changing and goes through each one of these. So I'm going to hit the highlights of them. And then again, I'm happy to send out notes and things once we're done, because I do want us to have question and answer time. So children that are birth to kindergarten, so about 0 to 5 years of age, they're learning to navigate what it means to be identified as a boy or a girl. We talked a couple weeks ago about from the moment you get a sonogram, if you decide to figure out what the gender of your baby or the sex of your baby is, might not be the gender of your baby. and so from the get-go, you are raising your child as a boy or a girl, most likely. So in this stage, you're just setting the foundation of how they are growing and changing. They are learning about the importance of touch. We love holding babies, but we also don't hold babies all of the time. So finding the importance of touch and the balance of that, discovering your body, becoming independent, these are all things that are physical development and stages of that, getting ownership over your body. In the relational development stage or part of things, children are at this age are developing trust with adults and learning about respect. They're learning about what their emotions are and being able to express if they're happy or sad or mad. So that is something in relationship building. It's still very much with people and how they rely on people. Faith development, at this age, if you were to go down to the nursery on a Sunday morning, you would hear songs that are being sung about God and see images and artwork on the walls that are helping bring God into worship spaces in classrooms. And ways that we are connecting faith and sexuality at this age are through things like dedications, in some faith traditions, baptism. Those are all things that involve touch. So Sterling or I will walk a child around the sanctuary. We're holding that child. Maybe the child is passed down the line of family. So while that is not a sexual act or a sexual thing, the touch is the part of the sexuality we're focusing on. And baptism's the same in some traditions where they sprinkle infants, something else that is touch-driven. Birth to kindergarten, I know that was quick and fast. Anyone have urgent questions that can't wait for 5 minutes, 3 minutes? Okay, lovely. Same setup for elementary school age children. For this, I have to flip to the book because that page is not in my binder. Children that are elementary school age, so about ages 6 to 10, or kindergarten through fifth grade, growing and changing, they are kind of in the waiting period. So they're not quite ready for puberty, but their body is preparing for that. And so in that, they are also learning a lot. Think about all the things that children are learning at this age and come home every day. While younger children are also learning constantly, this group is able a lot more to give that back out to you. And the best thing about this age is that elementary children, I wouldn't say all of the time, but most of the time are okay with their parents still being involved in their lives. As they get older, sometimes that may shift. But elementary kids are okay with parents being involved in their lives. Physical development at this stage, you will probably start talking about body image and body type with children and talk about different physical abilities. A lot of times children at this age are starting to play sports or do extracurricular activities. And so those are some things that they're able to do because their physical development has happened. A lot of times they are starting to become shy about their bodies, and children might want privacy when they're bathing or dressing. And that is okay, but you also need to be willing to step in and to help them if they need it and to talk about privacy and what that means with your child. Relational development at this stage is talking about being part of a larger community. So the child's community is growing. They're interacting with more children at school and more adults. Again, through extracurricular activities, they're interacting with more individuals. At church, there are more opportunities for children to join in activities such as godly play in our group or in our context. Maybe some churches have a choir or they're able to help with service projects that as a five-year-old or younger, they are not able to. Your role, parents' role in the elementary years, is to be a role model in all of these relationships. So keep that in mind as you're acting and interacting with folks. When your child is three, and if someone comes to knock on the door and wants to talk religion, they may not be aware of that conversation. But at eight, if you know that conversation that is happening or doesn't happen, and how you react to that, they're a lot more aware of. So just keep that in mind as you're interacting with your child. Faith development at this age. So at the younger age, the scripture stories are believed to be 100% true. Like, you just, what is in the Bible is in the Bible. They're very concrete thinkers. Children, as they get older, start to think a little more abstractly, so they can start to understand that there are things such as symbolism and metaphors, and they start to interact with stories in a new way. And so with that, when they're able to apply some of those things to their own lives, not being the best at everything is okay. And we talk about Jesus and disciples. And so finding ways that your child can connect their faith and their sexuality, you're able to do that a little more at this age than you are when they're a little bit younger. Questions, comments, concerns? Okay, good. Couple of resources for you all, and then we'll do some questions and answers. On each of the tables, there is a packet of resources that I just copied straight out of the back of Ott's book. So it's a little overwhelming. Also on your table, at the beginning of each of her chapters on development, she provides a quiz, a parenting quiz. I know that both of them say birth to five, but the one that is in smaller type is a different quiz. I just didn't change the header, and I apologize for that. So one of them is a parenting quiz for birth to five-year-olds, and the other one is for elementary school ages. So I encourage you to take these things home. And answer them. Like, how would you respond to your child's questions? Some of them are quite funny, they're kind of funny. I also have two resources up here that I was just amazed by in the book called It's Not the Stork and It's So Amazing. These are two of the three books that Ott recommends, and I have them up here if you would like to look through them. I will say that they are cartoon and hand-drawn, but that doesn't mean that they shy away from detail. So just keep that in mind if you buy this book without perusing it first. There will be images of penises and vaginas and babies coming out of vaginas. But I think that might be in one of the older, like in the It's So Amazing book. Have these books. They're fairly progressive, but if you would like to look through them, I would think that someone might be, I learned things going through them. So I have these if you'd like to look at them, but then the resources on the table are also very helpful for you. Quick anecdote. I got these books in the mail, and I asked my roommates if they wanted to have story time, which is not unusual in our house because I work with children. And they sat down, and I opened up the book, and both of their eyes got big, and they got off the couch and walked away, and we're like, we can't, no, we're not doing this. So let that be a fun warning for you. Okay. Questions, comments, helpful advice. We've got about 6 minutes left, 5 or 6 minutes. How can we help? How can you help us?
Keep in mind, next week is also for teenagers.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And Art will be back at the microphone. Thank goodness. Just kidding. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So talking about privacy and having a toddler learn ownership, one of the things that Ott says in her book is that a lot of times if you ask a child if they will give you a hug and they say no, then we guilt them into not, like, why, like, you act sad. I am guilty of this, and I am changing my ways after reading that, because even if you are not touching a child inappropriately. If that were to happen and, you know, someone, a child said, well, every time I'm asked if I can, if someone will hug me, I have to say yes. Then if something were to happen and something inappropriate was to happen, just thinking about those consequences and, you know, those, that sort of relationship. So that's a good point. Thank you for bringing that up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and there is someone in the room who always asks a child, can I touch you? Can I or hug? Can I tickle you? And always respects that. And that's one thing that I really appreciate, is that if the child says no, then okay, that's fine, you know, and keep going. Like, it's not a guilt trip thing. So, yeah.
Sorry to harp on the media thing, but deal stuff.
Yeah. And so it might not be something that we can avoid even if we try, but how do we set our children up well to be able to be comfortable having those conversations and asking questions? Is that's not an answer to your struggle, but oh yeah. So the comment was talking about, even if you do your best to protect your child on the internet, the next door neighbor might not be doing the same thing, or just accidentally stumbling across something. And again, might not be something you're ready to have that conversation about yet. So how do we, you know, I might not be ready to talk about intercourse or changing bodies, but my child has seen something, that sort of thing. Someone in the back. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that no means no, even when it's a young child or siblings or boys or girls, that will set children up and youth up well in the long run if someone was to say that down the road. Yeah. Okay. There you go. So information just being available more readily than it was 10, 15, 50 years ago. And how to have those conversations. Thank you all for a good night. I know it was a lot of information, so if you have questions, and I'm happy to email this out. Art will continue next week as we talk about youth, talking with youth and sexuality. So I hope that you will make an attempt to be here for that as well. And as always, keep asking questions and let us know how we can help.
Let's thank Kristen. So, as a former teenager and recovering youth minister of many years, how many of us were in youth groups where youth ministers had to do hand checks on trips, you know, under blankets and vehicles? When we talk about faith and sex, we have to acknowledge that some of what it means for youth to have the opportunity to spend intimate time together is they can cross the line into some interesting physically intimate places. So when we talk about the importance of talking about sex in church, sometimes we're talking about sex in church. Like, we have to really think it through and how we as a community will help prepare teenagers. So I hope you'll use that as a segue into next week's conversation as we continue the conversation. So we're grateful to Reverend Kroger, and we're grateful to Dr. Wright for his leadership next week. Blessings to you. Hope to see you on Sunday. Thanks, everybody.